This is Elizabeth Clark Stern, Imagination and the Soul, and Writing Your Soul Story, September 14th, 2012.
Okay, welcome everyone to this new program of our new season, coming out on this lovely summer evening. It's been great weather this summer, hasn't it? Of course, tonight we're very, very happy to have Elizabeth Clark Stern as our speaker. You know, she's a therapist and a playwright and a writer, and we do have her books here, of course, for sale. And she will be signing this at 8:30. Ken Kimmel's going to help introduce her on that particular critique of this book. And some of you may know her, of course, through her play, Out of the Shadows, which we did here, I think, twice in the past few years. And it was also done at the conference in South Africa. Yeah. Right. It's a great play. It's Tony Wolfe and Emma Jung, the two characters. And we do have a couple, we have a few copies of that. And I will let her speak.
Good evening, all of you. I'm Elizabeth. Welcome on this warm, beautiful, let's call it Indian summer evening. I invite you to take a moment, breathe, settle into your chairs, be aware of this present moment, the rustling of people, the noise outside, the zipping of a purse. Perhaps remember the beautiful grounds you crossed coming into the building, the feeling in the air, the rustle in the trees, the leaves sliding to the ground surreptitiously, perhaps not wanting us to be too freaked out that indeed winter is coming. In his play, Our Town, Thornton Wilder wrote of life in a small town and placed his characters in its center, the town in the center of our country, of the world, of the universe. Take a moment to experience this perspective. We are here now, and we are part of something much, much larger. Imagination. We use this word all the time. When I say the word imagination, what comes up for you? Anybody?
Pretend.
Creativity.
Imagery.
Imagery.
Fantasy.
Dreaming.
Play.
Stories.
Fun.
All right. Try closing your eyes now, and I will say it again. Imagination. What do you see, hear, taste, smell, remember? When you're ready, open your eyes. Come back to the room. What did you see this time?
A path.
A path. What?
A horizon.
A horizon. Getting chills, you guys.
Animals.
Mmm.
Clear, bright, white light.
Clear, bright, white light.
A lotus plant.
What, sir?
A lotus plant.
A lotus plant. Mmm. I can smell it as you say that. Beautiful. The American Heritage Dictionary defines imagination as the formation of a mental image of something that is neither perceived as real, who said that, nor present to the senses. Not real, not present to the senses. Jung would beg to differ. If we conceive of the imagination as a communication from the unconscious mind, Jung's words are illustrative. Quote, "The realm of the unconscious mind is a self-contained world, having its own reality, of which we can only say that it affects us as we affect it. Precisely what we say about our experience in the outer world. And just as material objects are the constituent elements of this world, so psychic factors constitute the objects of the other, inner world." Unquote. This is from Collective Works 7. He gets even more committed in his commentary on The Secrets of the Golden Flower. Quote, "It seems to me reasonable to accord the psyche the same validity as the empirical world and to admit that the former has as much reality as the latter." Webster's dictionary does come through with a quite wonderful second definition. Imagination is the ability to deal with and confront reality creatively. Thank you. This opens the idea that we can engage the real phenomenon of imagination to experience a new perspective on our life story, to cope with inevitable tragedies, conflicts, or problems more effectively. Ideally, the creative imagination can help us confront hidden aspects of ourselves and forge a new relationship with the inner healer, the inner loving parent, the inner warrior, the inner great mother, and all the powerful archetypes within us. Since our focus this evening is on imagination and the soul, I would like to fold the two together, rather as my grandma made biscuits on a steamy summer morning. How does imagination ally with the soul to bring forth healing images and ignite the flowing reality of the archetypal soul? In Beyond the Pleasure Principle, Freud suggested that we possess, all of us, quote, an emotional self-writing mechanism, akin to the physical body's innate abilities to heal wounds. In the Red Book, after completing copious dialogues with all of the archetypes of his unconscious, Jung concluded, quote, I came to myself, a giddy and pitiful figure. My I, the touchstone, is being alone with myself. Lao Tzu tells us, quote, without even going out the door, one can know the whole world. I got that on a celestial seasoning box. And beyond all of these legendary experts, there's the reality of our own experience. What is your experience of this emotional self-writing mechanism, this inner healer, this voice, whispering to you in waking life, seemingly coming out of nowhere, or what I call the offstage dream voice that says, go back! Don't marry him, and other things like that. Oh, if only I'd listened. Oh, God. I invite you to come with me on a short journey in search of this place within yourself that wants to gather all the pieces of you into a loving whole. If you choose, close your eyes. Be aware of your breath. Breathe in. Breathe out. Release any tension in your jaw, your hands, your face, your feet. Allow all the tensions of the week to drift away. Be aware of this room, the sounds, the sense of place. Allow your attention to go within, to the sense of place deep in yourself. Continue to breathe. Be aware of your connection to the life force for unity within you. Search for an image, a memory, a time, a place, an image from a dream, some place in you when you could feel this gentle movement toward wholeness in your world, in yourself. A sense of this connection. Take just a moment of transition, knowing you will be leaving this image, memory, or feeling. Take your time. When you are ready, return to the room and open your eyes. Some of you are already writing this down. I would invite you to write down what you saw. Or felt or heard. In my experience, this very simple exercise can touch the sacred. Would anyone like to share, not necessarily the content, because I realize this can be extremely private and you should guard it if you like, but perhaps just what the process was like for you? Anyone? One of the images that often came to me when I used to do this, and, well, as I do it, one of the first images that would come was when I was in the third grade, so that would make me around 8 years old, lying in front of a window. It was a hot, sweaty day, and I'd been playing, and I was curled up with my dog, and the window was open. And I just remember this, the curtain blowing over me, this light organza curtain, and this sense of oneness just sort of flooded into me from the curtain, the breeze, my little dog snoring right beside me, my sweat, I could feel my sweat drying as the wind blew over me. It can be something so simple, and I have remembered that all my life. Just now, among other things, you created a symbol. The flow from imagination to symbol allows the psyche to work her magic in the conscious and unconscious life. And one way to nurture the life of the soul is to engage in symbol making every day. We were just talking about how hard it is so often to hold on to these archetypal realities, whether it's from a dream or, you know, you can often develop a whole relationship with your archetypal good mother. And then something happens, it seems. Life sweeps it away. So I would invite you to think about what I call imaginal meditation, very similar to what we just did every day, using breath, relaxation, the invitation to bring forth images. Visual, auditory, communications from the unconscious that create this flow of symbols. I say flow because the imaginal mind usually wants diversity. It loves the development of themes expressed in different forms and associations. It may be me with my little dog today, and tomorrow it may be just a blue sky, or hearing a loving voice, or silence. But if the intention is given to hold this space as sacred and to be held, you can use the practice in so many ways. If you're facing a challenging day, say you have a job interview or you've got to give a lecture, write down questions before you are beginning imaginal meditation. What kind of support do you need today? Who do you need it from? Do you need it from your inner warrior because you've got to face some really tough stuff? Or do you need it from your archetypal father because you just want to play with him today and run in the fields and throw a ball to him the way you used to? You can develop an inner cast of characters who can come forth at different times. I know when I'm going on a difficult journey, I ask for as much backup as I can. Someone mentioned Jack Kornfield earlier, and I went to one of his lectures once, and he said, you know, you need to just put gods all behind you in big rows because you need backup. And I'd never thought of that before. I think it's a lovely image. And you can do it in your own mind. Call forth, you have no idea who's standing behind me right now. And you can use the kind of short version of this. That's why active imagination, as some of you may know, is the process that Jung wrote, the Red Book. He wrote by himself. It is conceived of as a practice that you do in writing, in private, where you, in essence, interview these archetypes and have them respond to you, and you write out these whole long scenes. Well, a lot of folks don't have time to do that or feel that that's their calling to do it that way. So this kind of imaginal meditation, if you're in the grocery store and there's a long line and you're frustrated and you feel yourself getting angry and you want to scream at the clerk, you can just take a breath and say, oh, where are you, mother, good mother? Oh, give me some advice right now. Just stand beside me. Or you can just leave it as a blank question. What do I need right now? Who knows? A cloud of smoke could come and just encircle you with this imaginal tool. And you can breathe, and you end up going through the line and saying to this nice person, how are you? How's your day? And you feel better about yourself. Of course, there's a natural opportunity of the flows from imaginal meditation to the canvas of a painting, a journal, a story, a garden, a song, a dance, or any form of art or creative expression. One reason why moving into creative expression can be so powerful is because symbolic play, symbolic art of all forms, we are outside the story as the creator, but we're inside of it at the same time. It's this marvelous paradox. An example, in the story, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, Lisbeth is both the warrior and the victim at the same time. For the memory of her abuse throbs in every cell of her body, even the cells along her back, tattooed with a fierce, elegant dragon. From her tragedy, she made a symbol which helped her embody the archetypal power of the warrior and to never be a victim again. And this is so healing often. Someone once complained to me that his journal was just a bunch of drivel. He just had all this complex written stuff that he complained and complained about. I knew that he wrote song lyrics, so I said, what if you just write a poem? Try to take some of all of the drivel and distill it into just a few lines. He came back the next week and he was like, oh my goodness, now I can get down to the grief. Now it's not just a bunch of garbage. And he read me this poem and he cried. And art, paring our story down to symbols, to essence, allows us to integrate our conflicts again and again, literally creating a new I. And if we want more scientific perspectives on it, a lot of the science now in neuroscience, neuropsychology, which is the cutting edge field, a few years ago I went to see this lecture, this fellow at Harvard who gave this a whole day presentation about the neurons and the this and the that and the synapses, and boy, I could map the whole brain and the amygdala and all this. And at the end I was waving my hand saying, okay, I got it, this is great. What about treatment? He goes, what? Creative arts! I was like, oh my God, to come all the way back around to that. And he talked about in children especially, generating the power of the creative mind integrates all of these different neuroscientific nodules and synapses. So here we are, right back to Jung. And in my experience, children have a natural making symbol ability that we have, as adults, can only aspire to, and we can nourish in playful and the unselfconscious parts of ourselves. Most children, especially traumatized children, have a strong instinct to include a symbol of a protective, loving, powerful, magical, divine spirit. When they step into a therapist's office, they don't have judgments about, is there a God, or am I creating something that's real or not real? They have the freedom to create spontaneously with their imaginal minds. Freud's emotional self-writing mechanism, Jung's touchstone of the self, Lao Tzu's universe in your own house, something in us scoops around again and again like the spiral form in nature to integrate all the parts of us, flawed, magnificent, human, divine. Like the moon, we become whole, and then we become slivered again. But we keep moving. We keep becoming. Psyche wants wholeness. A 3-year-old girl came into my office one day. She had disclosed some dreadful abuse and was here to tell me about it. She chewed on her fingers and glanced nervously around the room. Then she saw something. She went right to my shelf and pulled down the tiny figure I'm going to pass around now. An angel, she exclaimed. And this figure, I don't even know how it got into my office. It's like one of those penny fairies you get in a gumball machine. But this child picked this thing up, and she handled it reverently, put it on the ledge atop my sand tray. And then, with that little angel watching, she summoned the courage to fill the tray with stories that told of the abuse. When she got scared, she would pick the angel up and hold it to her ear, listen and go, okay, do this whole dialogue. In this way, with this protective divine spirit so alive in her mind, she was able to portray the terrible things that had happened to her. Similarly, I saw a boy who sees the tiny dragon figure I'm about to pass around the room. He said, this is baby dragon, Clark Stern, take notes. Dutifully pulled out my paper and proceeded to write down in detail the narrative that unfolded. The other prominent character was Mother Dragon. Oops. This was clearly not his mortal mother, for Mother Dragon had extraordinary powers, protected baby dragon, and he pulled out a nest. I had a little, one of those Easter, you know, favor things, and he pulled out this nest and put baby dragon in there and had Mother Dragon fight off all of these devils and demons. And it was, oh, she had extraordinary powers. She protected him, and then she gave him powers of his own. This child was doing a form of Jung's active imagination. Jung conceived of it as a process done alone. Well, it's just that this little boy, you know, enabled me to be his scribe, and therefore all of this story came out. And he simply had me tell his story of his active imagination. Another wonderful expression of active imagination is the world of story, literature, myth, fairy tales, where the path of the soul is often told with a child protagonist. he or she is often quickly orphaned, or the child is on the run from an abusive parent or a wicked stepmother. Hugo, the movie that came out this last year, comes to mind, Huckleberry Finn, and so many fairy tales where this boy is the village idiot and ends up winning the kingdom. Success requires courage, loving friends, magical guides who embody the divine. Each of us begins life as an infant. We become a child, conscious of the world and our own feelings. We encounter loss, obstacles, and struggle to find our way home. In this life journey, we can return again and again to the archetypal child within. We can view loss and tragedy with fresh eyes and find new dimensions of curiosity, compassion, and generosity. In my own childhood, I discovered the Chronicles of Narnia. And I don't know how many of you also got through difficult childhoods with Aslan as the symbol of the divine within you. Yes, some people are nodding. I know I did. And I didn't realize it then, but in feeling the reality of that lion and that he would show up at just the most unpredictable but just the right times, I was developing a relationship with the divine. Now I've created my own literature. Soul Stories is a collection of two novels, Safari to Mara and Aria of the Horned Toad, for older children and for the inner child in all of us. I'd like to read for you tonight from my imaginal symbol-making mind to yours. But first, I would invite you to go with me on another journey. Many of you have paper and pen nearby, so settle back in your chairs. If you choose, close your eyes. Once again, let all the tensions go. Put your notebooks on the floor for the moment, or just hold on to them. Yeah, and if they fall, that's okay. Release the tension in your jaw, in your eyes, your hands. Be aware of your body, nestled in the chair. Attuned to the sense of the room, this moment. Allow yourself to go inside to the place within. Be aware of your breath, the slow inhale, exhale. Choose an age for yourself. You can go back as far in time as you like. You can be who you were yesterday, who you are right now. How old are you? Where are you living? Where are you in this moment? Are you inside your home? Outside? A place you loved as a child? A place you love now? What are the sounds? Smells? Voices, pets. The feeling in the air. What is your sense of your body? Your toes, your eyelids. What do you think about? What do you dream about? Wherever you are, whatever your age, take yourself beyond your immediate surroundings to a grassy field. It is late afternoon, the sun coming gently through the tall trees. It's as if the sun is breathing as it falls down through the trees. One particular tree catches your eye. What kind of tree is it? Does it have leaves? Cones? Flowers? Perched securely in the tree, you discover a house. A ladder up the trunk of the tree invites you. You put your feet on the rungs of the ladder. It feels ancient, solid. You go up, up, until you find yourself facing the door of the treehouse. What is the texture of the door? Its color. You touch the doorknob. It opens. Inside, you discover a whole new world of objects, sounds, smells. What do you see? At the center of the room sits a figure in a large, high-backed chair. Who is this? You know in your heart this figure has arrived just to be with you this night. In this treehouse. Who is it? Allow yourself to see, feel, experience all of this entity. Does it speak to you? What does it say? Do you have a question for this figure? Do you receive an answer? The figure tells you It is time for you to go. But you may return. You are invited to return. What final words do you have to say? As you look upon this face, that could be new to you or could be someone you know so well. When you have said your final words, turn, open the door, look out upon the forest, and see all of the trees from this great height. Feel the sense of the air, the sense of light and shadow. Come down the ladder. Walk across the meadow. When you are ready, open your eyes and return to this place, this room. I encourage you to write anything that seemed pertinent or important. Some part of you that came out in that imaginative exercise that we just did. Would any of you like to share anything about the process? Were you surprised by anything that happened? Yes. Oh, really?
I couldn't figure out why a Russian movie showed up. I thought it would be more like, more what I'm familiar with, like ancestral, like my Irish relatives or something like that. But it's a Russian movie. Like, that was really unusual.
Uh-huh. Does that seem like good advice?
Yeah, it does. It really fits into kind of the context of my current life situation. Mm-hmm. So it makes a lot of sense.
Great. Thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah. Anyone else? Yes. Slowed you down.
And I was more reflective of what I would do the second half of my life.
You were more reflective of what you would do the second half of your life. What you didn't do well in the first half, you would make up for in the second. Fascinating. Meditative, yeah. Huh?
No Russian.
That's marvelous, yes. Thank you very much. That is a very open sort of response. You know, you can go so many ways with that. Anyone else?
I saw D.T. Suzuki sitting in the high back chair.
Oh. Would you like to tell us who that is, for those that may not know?
Yeah.
Right.
96, actually, I think he predated Jung by about 5 years.
Isn't he still doing documentaries on PBS on environment?
Yeah.
Oh, that must be another Suzuki. Oh, okay.
David's.
Yes, I am. Right. Oh, yes, but I've read this fellow's books, too. Well, what do you think it was, what was significant
well, actually,
that...
you conjured it when you talked about the high back chair.
Yeah.
You know, in the central area. And,
sure.
It's actually an old dream image of mine.
Ah.
Which I was in the presence of D.T. Suzuki. I won't go any further into that. He had no more to say this time than he did last time.
Well, that's the essence of Zen, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right. He's not going to tell you what to do. Oh, that's marvelous. Yeah. Anyway. Yes?
Well, there's a tree that I see on my daily walk. You know, I thought, this is the only grassy place that I go by on my walk. And there's a tree I like. So I was getting this nice image that there's a tree house. So I'm going up the tree house, and I was visualizing this tree house. And then you said there's this guy sitting in here in a high-back chair. And I said, why are you sitting in a high-back chair in this beautiful place? You can see this beautiful wilderness up here. And he didn't say a word. And I said, you know, basically, I think I, when you said those words, I just locked into my feelings about, you know, how Western society is, how it was uptight and, you know, worried about their business and making money and all that stuff. And anyway, this person never said it, completely ruined my buzz.
Oh, no. I'm so sorry. Well, see, I'm giving you guided images tonight, right? And the thing is, if you do it yourself, you supply the images. You supply the context. You don't have anybody in a high-back chair. You know your relationship to the tree, right? I'm just giving you kind of a jump start to get your mind going. And each one of you have had such marvelously different responses. That's great. Anyone else have anything they'd like to share? Well, I think we're about right where we should be in terms of time. So I'd like to share a little bit from my book, Soul Stories. And let's see. Let's start with Arya of the Horned Toad. It's a story about a little girl, 10-year-old girl growing up in Austin, Texas. Hello, Ken, you're here. Come in. She lives with her mom and dad. And at the beginning of the story, it starts with a 4th of July talent show in the garage of her house. And two little children from down the block come and join. And Beatrice is our main character. She's very excited because she had a dream last night that a horny toad, you know, with these little lizards, crawled out of her eye in the dream. And when she woke up and came out into the garden, she captured a horny toad in a box. There it was. So this is proof that dreams can come true. And this is the premise that guides a lot of the story. So her little friends come, and they see the horned toad, and one of them dumps the horned toad out. He runs out to the back into the cottonwoods, and Beatrice, we take it up there where they're running out after the horny toad. "Hush, y'all," I whisper. "I see something before my eyes, something magnificent. Something that has never appeared in our grove before, or maybe on this planet Earth." I can feel Reese staring at me. I don't move my eyes to her. I keep them on this glory of creation right in front of me. I feel her eyes shifting away from me. She takes in breath. "Oh, my goodness sakes alive!" I let out a sigh. "Oh, she can see him, too." "What are y'all staring at?" says Pear. We don't say one word. "What's going on, y'all? Giving me the willies." Pear's voice trails off. I feel him staring too, trembling with awe. All of a sudden, we stare up at my horny toad, my darling custard, big as a dinosaur, licking a beetle off the cottonwood branch 20 feet above us. He savors his treat, those humongous dragon eyes half closing in the joy of consumption. I feel the tassels on my 4th of July flapper dress shaking. Oh. Custer's ears, wherever they are in his spiky head, perk up. His jet brown eyes, big as basketballs, rotate down and take us in. "He's gonna eat us," says Pear. "He could," says Reese, her arms aflutter. "Maybe," I whisper, "maybe we don't taste good as a beetle." We draw in breath all at once. He plants his four claws right inches from our face, opens his mouth, a quivering blue tongue reaching toward us. If I can get this puppet on. Such a sound, like a waterfall of gravel. He closes his eyes in total rapture. "He's singing to us," whispers Reese. I put my hand over my heart to stop my tassels from shaking. I step toward him. If he's going to eat me, so be it. But I've got to know what's what. "Custard?" He opens his eyes and looks down at me. Is that name okay for you? His blue tongue whips gently across my face, scratchy, warm. "He likes you," said Reese. "We're kindred spirits, Puddin' and Custard," Puddin' being Beatrice's nickname. I reach out my sweaty hand and touch his nose, craggy as a rock. "I still think he's gonna eat us," said Pear. I look deep into Custard's eyes. "Is this the dream country? Where you came from, remember? You crawled right out of my eyeballs." He lifts his mighty claw to the old cottonwood tree towering way above us. A strange light comes from inside the bark, like from the sun glowing deep inside the core of the tree. Whoa! "He appears to be exercising his prodigious vocal cords," says Reese. I want to ask her what the heck prodigious means, but I'm afraid I'm going to sound stupid. He sings on, his face drawn in pain, one claw over his heart. At the end of the song, he weeps and takes a bow. We are all plumb stunned. "A horny toad aria. That's an opera song," whispers Reese. "My daddy played opera all the time. He learned to love it from Papa Ben. You sing beautiful, Custard, in a horny toad sort of way. I sure miss my daddy." "Shut up," says Pear. Custard reaches down his blue tongue to Reese's face, licking off her tears. Pear lines up behind her. By and by, Custard takes to licking his face, too. So the story evolves back and forth between the dream country and their real life in Austin, Texas. And back and forth and back and forth. And this chapter begins after they have made it out of one of the places most dangerous. "It's night when I come to, sand under my belly still warm from the heat of the day. I check around. Pear and Reese sleep on Custard's belly, the mighty toad snoring so loud they can hear it on the moon. We all made it out of our worst nightmare. I can't believe it. Then I hear a rustling. Reese and Pear and Custard are still sleeping. What made that noise? Oh, my heart. The land sail is right in front of us, moon on her peach sail brighter than the real moon above us. In its brilliance, I can see the driver, her face in shadow, whispering to herself, 'My, my, naughty pie.' She lifts Reese's desert bike like it's light as a butterfly and tucks it into her boat, along with Pear's scooter and my melted-up bubble bike. I can't believe it, her being so close. I let myself breathe, watching her hands move fast as fireflies to arrange things in the tiny space on her land sail so everything fits just fine. I take a deep breath and open my mouth. Nothing comes out. She turns away, reaching for the wheel. Oh, I can't let her get away. 'Ma'am?' Her face snaps to mine. I holler. Her eyes are humongous dark wells, like she had them dilated at the eye doctor's and they put in enough dilator medicine to see back to the dawn of time. 'Ma'am, excuse me, or maybe it's not ma'am, maybe you're a pixie or something. What do I call you, Madam Pixie?' She reaches across me and lifts Custard's monster bike into her boat. We all made a mess of your vehicles. I'm so sorry, but we went through your worst nightmare, and we came out this way, all this way, to find the dream maker. Can you help us, Madam Pixie, please? This dream maker has got to make a dream to cure my mama so she won't drink anymore, and she'll stay home with us. She looks at me full on. I peer down into those eyes, those deep wells of eternity. I'm shaking all over, but the chiggers in my belly are real still, like they're in awe or something. Her face is like the side of a mountain in the hill country, all worn with time. Her skin the color of all the people on earth. Turn one way, she's black. Turn another way, she's white. Tilt her chin, she's every color in between. She wears a little brown shift, like a milkmaid or something. I think maybe she can't understand me at all. She's just a worker bee sent out to collect the ingredients for the dream maker. Something squawks in the boat. She's got the whooping crane in there stuffed in with the giant seahorse and the helicopter-sized damselfly sitting on top of the solar auto engine. Madam Pixie, I know you're fixing all this stuff for some real big dream. I know how important it is to bring low-cost solar car to the world so we can stop global warming and all, but please, ma'am, it's so important to me, to Reese and her brother Pear, to find the real dream maker so he can make a big dream for my mama and for Reese and Pear's mom and daddy so they can all step out into the world of Austin, Texas and be good and, well, sober. She blinks. Her eyes look different. Not scary deep wells, just plain old human eyes, every color on earth looking right at me. She tosses out the funky old wooden boat, a funky old wooden lifeboat, and I shake Pear and Custard, and they stare at that pixie, covering their eyes from the bright moonlight on her land sail. I get in the lifeboat, pulling Custard and Pear and Reese after. I don't know how we can all fit in this tiny thing, but we can. A great mystery of the universe. Seat belts, please. Her voice is low, smooth, soft, strong at the same time. It sounds familiar, but it couldn't be, could it? We strap in, and she takes off, fast as light. One last short chapter. I wake up in my bed smelling coffee. I run down the hall to Mom and Daddy's room. The bed's all rumpled. Nobody's there. Mama's sitting at the kitchen table drinking coffee. Hey, I say. Hey, where's Daddy? He left at the crack of dawn. Well, where's he working? Down in San Antonio? Didn't say. He just said he had to get going early, had things to do. You hungry? You sit, Mama. I'll make myself an egg in the nest. She's drinking coffee. That's good. That's a real good thing. I pull down the whole wheat bread out of the bread box and press the cookie cutter jackrabbit into the middle. Mama taught me to toss it in the skillet, crack an egg in the middle. It's always been my favorite breakfast. Me and Mom and Daddy used to make up names for all the jackrabbits, do little skits with them. Daddy play Papa Jackrabbit, Mama'd be Mama, and I was always their little bunny. We went on and on with this, laughing. So much laughing in those days. I cut out two little jackrabbits, secretly naming them. While I cook, they look up at me from the pan, making wishes. I didn't tell Mama. I don't want her to feel bad, missing Daddy and the laughing times. Can I make you some eggs, Mama? I'm not hungry, thank you. I don't smell anything on her but coffee. Oh, dear God, let it last just till we find the dream maker. I feel dizzy, like an old movie Daddy showed me one time, When Worlds Collide. I'm seeing the dream country in my head, Pear and Reese and me heading off in the lifeboat on the scent of the dream maker. And then here's Mama before me, drinking coffee. Oh, let there be enough time to get Mama fixed before she starts wanting something besides coffee. Be still, my heart. Let me make you some eggs, Mama. You always say people need protein in the morning. Mama half smiles. I said that, did I? Yes, ma'am. Oh, I'm working up to it, Puddin'. Oh, I lose my breath. She used to call me Puddin' all the time before she found her gin voice. that only knows how to call me Beatrice Delilah. She looks at me through a mess of honey-colored yellow hair. I say lots of stuff to you, don't I? I move my eyes down to the jackrabbit on my plate. Is she telling me she remembers all the mean, horrible things her gin voice says? Or is she just talking about regular stuff like eat your protein? I can't tell. I remember everything you say, Mama. She whistles, running her long fingers through her hair. More coffee, Mama? Yes, ma'am. Fill her up. I pour a fresh cup. She stares down into it. I dump 3 lumps of sugar in and a splash of cream. Stir it up real good. I don't want to look at her face. What do y'all do out there all day in the cottonwoods? She asks, taking a big sip. I don't like to lie to my mama, but she'd never believe in a million years if I had told her the truth. Nothing. Sure eats up a lot of your time, there's nothing. Sorry. I don't mind. I'm glad you found kids your own age to play with. Last summer you just hung around the house mourning. I watch it happen. She slurped down all of her coffee. She looks over at Daddy's chair. I see it in her toes, smacking the floor with her bare feet. I can see it go all the way up her body. She pulls back her hair like she's so hot she's going to catch on fire. Her eyes, a wildness to them, like a pony I rode at the fair who bucked so hard I had to get off. What are you looking at, Beatrice? Nothing. Stop staring at me. You always stare with those eyes. I run outside. Heat of the day hits me with a roar of the cicadas. My bare feet pound on the sidewalk, hot as barbecue coals. I grab Reese and Pear off their breakfast waffles and head to the cottonwood grove. We got no time to lose to find the dream maker. The end.
Thank you. Okay. Does Ken need an introduction? No. Ken Kimmel is a local Jungian analyst, scholar, prince, good fellow, and his wonderful book, Eros and the Shattering Gaze, right? Did I say it right?
You did.
Came out last year. And it's a marvelous book. It's on male narcissism. And I came here about exactly this time last year and talked about having read the book as a woman and how illuminating it was as a woman to read a book on male narcissism because your own shadow is on every page. So I really encourage you, if you've not read Eros and the Shattering Gaze, to do so.
Wait a minute. It's my turn to gush about your book.
Okay.
Thank you. I had an opportunity to read Elizabeth's 2 short stories last year, and I wrote something, a review for it. I was really moved, and I think I'd like to read it to you, what I wrote at the time. It's entitled Dreamscapes Within and Without. Majestic, touching, fanciful, courageous, heart-wrenching, meaningful, soulful. These words flow easily from the reverie I feel upon completion of Elizabeth Clark Stern's fine new work of fiction, Soul Stories. These are 2 tales of young daughters from different continents, one devastated by her mother's sudden loss, the other watching helplessly as her mother is slowly pulled from her, morphing into something she can no longer recognize as mother. These painful events call upon each to embark upon healing journeys deep into nature's interior spaces, one onto the African plains, the other into the vastness of the imagination. I'm reminded of the lonely early childhood of the analytical psychologist Carl Jung, whose deep dissociation from relationships was healed only through his immersion in fantasy life and play. This is the kind of psychological depth that the author attempts to reach, and I believe she achieves it. Clark Stern, the playwright, is evident throughout in the rich and evocative scenes, character development, and psychological insight, astounding given the brief cross-section of life portrayed in the two novellas. This is a book that is written from the heart and touches the soul. It's good therapy, one that I gladly recommend to my patients and have, colleagues, family, and friends.
Thank you.
Yeah. So there are some questions that I thought would be useful for us to think about together, and we'll see what comes from them.
Okay.
We're probably not going to have the time to do all the questions. I think I've got about 20 of them.
Uh-huh. Well, and I'd also like to maybe open it up to the audience at some point, too.
Yes. So the first question is, why do you write?
Why do I breathe? Well, I think I started writing about the time everything fell apart in my family. I actually wrote a Greek tragedy. I must have been in the sixth grade, and I had found a book of mythology in the back of the classroom that says, I've still got it, it says Texas Public Schools, stamped all over it. And these were rejects. Nobody wanted these books. And I was so bored in the classroom. I had been reading Greek mythology. And when everything fell apart in the family, I wrote my own original Greek tragedy, and we performed it in the garage. And at the time, of course, I didn't correlate it to the horrible tragedies going on in my own family. But I think it's been my survival and my lifeline.
Your answer intuited the next question that I had, was what does Aria of the Horned Toad say about the trauma of growing up in an addicted family, and how can adults use some of the tools that the children developed in the story?
Whew, that's a big question. I think a lot of it has to do with owning the feelings, the reality of the inner child that were not able to be expressed at the time. When a child is going through a traumatic family experience, using creative tools is one of the few ways to literally escape what's going on around them. They can't say, well, they can try saying, Mom, you're drunk, sober up, but it never does any good. You learn pretty quickly that addicted family parents just fall apart, or they take it out on you. You're only setting yourself up for more abuse, etc. So you develop all these strategies. As adults, you see, we get to feel the reality of the child, learn how to protect and love the child inside of us. And I think that's one of the greatest analytical challenges for an adult in therapy, is to learn how to love themselves if they were not properly loved. Mm-hmm. And you can do that. One of the tools to do that is through active imagination, through loving all the parts of you that can come alive in creative play, fantasy, art, etc.
Well, you intuited the third question. So you have a Jungian orientation as a therapist. What's the difference between writing fiction or plays and what Jung called active imagination?
I think if you're writing plays and you ever show them to anybody, even in the garage, you want to make them as good as you can, and you often agonize over every sentence. I know I did, but poor proofreader in Out of the Shadows. I mean, both Out of the Shadows and Soul Stories, but especially Soul Stories. I'm surprised she didn't just scream and give up, because I got so particular about every little sentence and all of this. So I think craft comes into play if you're writing for an audience and you want to get your work published. But it's a real slippery slope, because you can become so self-critical that you end up chewing yourself to bits, and you can even ruin your work. So you really have to learn how to give the muse her day and let the work flow and sometimes just say, oh, that's enough. I've rewritten that paragraph. Enough, enough, enough. The wonderful poet Mary Oliver, whom I'm sure many of you know and love, I saw her a few years ago down at downtown, and she said, somebody asked her questions, they're like this. She said, well, I do the best I can. I really try to make them as good as I can, but in the end, I write because I have. They come out of me, and I can't stop them. And so I think you play that balance. I think active imagination, as I understand it, is completely spontaneous and for yourself and your analyst, and it can become something that is shaped for something that an audience could consume, but doesn't
but
have to be.
It's without the editor.
It's without the editor, without, yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. So picking up on the notion of active imagination, why is creativity so important in the healing of the psyche?
Well, I think it's because if we're cut off from the creative, that's one of the pathway to hell, and certainly to depression and to other things. I think creativity is the life force itself. And the more that we can nourish that and unlock parts of ourselves that respond to the creative urge, I think that's the best Prozac on the planet. And I think that's a well-kept secret in some circles that would, you know, throw me out the window for saying something like that. But, and I'm not saying that you don't need medication sometimes, because I think that can be very helpful as well. But when it comes to the depth work and being able to distill kind of this frantic notions of the complex down into a symbol, down into something that you know resonates from the depths of your soul, that's the healing agent. That's the higher power. And if you're not in touch with that and you don't work to build a relationship with that inner voice, I think you're just kind of dancing around the problem, not really going down and changing yourself.
It sort of speaks to another question leading into at some point in the lives of both of your young protagonists, trauma and loss seems to bring about depression. And I'm wondering if you could talk about the relationship between trauma, loss, creativity, and depression.
Well, I'm sure you're all aware that there's so many great artists out there who have suffered so much from depression, from trauma, from bipolar, schizophrenia, all of those kinds of things. And I think it has to do with the quickening of how the psyche experiences trauma and then a flip over into creativity. The analyst John Lockhart wrote an article, and I can't remember the name of the article, but in it, John Nash, the fellow from Beautiful Mind, if you've seen that movie or read the
Words
book.
Words as Eggs.
Yeah. That's the name of the article?
I think so.
Okay. What struck me so much, someone asked him, they said, my God, you're this brilliant scientist, mathematician. How in the world could you have taken these voices seriously, the voices that came out of your madness? And John Nash said, it came from the same place. The voices of the schizophrenia came from the same place that gave him the insight to create all these mathematical formulations. I mean, I think that says it. It's the same thing, the creative and what splits us. And ideally, you can not surrender to to the depression. I think you come to the place where you can discern, okay, here I go, down into this place again. I know my impulse for writing so many things comes from loss, from sorrow, from feeling unhinged or disconnected. And I seek the creative force to get me whole again, to get me integrated again. So I think they're absolutely intimate. Creation and destruction, which is that the Hindu goddess that
Shiva.
Has Shiva. Yeah. Here she is dancing. We create and we destroy. We create and we destroy.
Mm-hmm. Makes me think of von Franz's words about depression, that feeling the lead of depression, and in some cases, not all, but in some cases where she would encourage her patients to drop down into the depression, to see what it's about, to give mm-hmm. it a voice, mm-hmm. and from out of that there can be this kind of pulling off the cap on something that yeah. can be frightening to the ego's perspective, but mm-hmm. something very powerful, and something that's not ego, you know, that's something that mm-hmm. can be creative and expressive and primal and volatile, but ultimately you know, bringing about a deeper sense of oneself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, absolutely.
Something else that came to mind as you were speaking was with Mara, that's the African heroine in the first story. Could you talk about her process in dealing with the two major losses in her story? First loss is her mother, and then the loss of her beloved zebra.
Hmm. Well, Safari Tamara is about loss. It's about coming to the place where you really draw in the spirit of the divine. Hmm. Ngai is the spirit of the Maasai. And Ngai is both masculine and feminine, and in everything, in all things. And she begins, after she loses her mother, to talk to Ngai in the spirit, in the moon. She sees Ngai and talks to her. And what gets her out of the loss of her mother is forging a relationship with this little zebra that she hides. She rescues him and hides him. And he, too, has lost his mother. And they forge a very wonderful, I think, relationship. And it becomes secret and sacred to her to have this animal that is so precious to her. But part of her growth as a little girl is coming to the place where she realizes she must take her place in her tribe, and so must her zebra. So it's about growth in that sense. It's about one loss leading her to a place where she can grow so that she can sustain the second loss, and one would assume the other losses in our lives. I mean, you look at especially those of us who are no longer spring chickens, and we are aging, losses are piling up. And I think, really, Barb and I have talked about this, that the Amazon and the crone are emerging as really very strong, necessary archetypes for this time in our lives. You need great courage to be able to go with the inevitable losses and see the larger picture. Yeah.
You portray the divine in both books, and I'm wondering if you could talk about what your concept of the divine is, and why do you feel so compelled to include it in the experience of your characters?
Well, I didn't plan it. I didn't start out thinking either one of them would have anything to do with the divine. But, you know, I don't write these books. Somebody else writes these books. And she wanted to have a lot of it be about that. So I just came out. I couldn't stop it. Is the honest truth. So I said, whew, that's wild. Oh, okay. So she talks to the goddess in the moon. All right. Woo, okay. I just let it happen. And I think it's obviously, me trying to work out my relationship with the divine and what I think that is and how I think that functions in human life, because I think that's what's important, is how it changes our behavior, not what theoretical or philosophical beliefs we might hold. It's who are we? How do we treat people? How do we learn to love ourselves and one another? That's what matters.
Maybe you just answered this question, but maybe not. Do you have any hopes as to what people will experience in reading Soul Stories?
Well, I hope they just get inside the characters and experience love and loss and hope and can relate to things in their own lives. I had hoped that anybody, a child or an adult, who has been through similar experiences could say, oh, wow, if Mara can be that brave, maybe I can be that brave too. Or if, boy, oh boy, that what Beatrice went through with her mother, I remember feeling the same thing with my alcoholic mother. And yet, she stuck with it. She stuck with her mom, and she stuck with herself and learned how important she was. Those kind of things. Mainly, you know, that you feel something and that it touches you. That's what I would hope.
Is there any question that I haven't asked that you'd like me to ask?
Well, I'd like to ask the audience if they have any questions.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD, and it included some images. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.